This is Margaret Cho, and you're listening to The Bicast, podcasting for the bisexual community.
Welcome to Bicast, a podcast for the bisexual community. We are speaking with Nancy Marcus of Bylaw. Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you so much. We are really happy to have you here today. Can you just fill us in? What is Bylaw?
Bylaw is the first ever national organization of bisexual and bi-allied law professors, students, and lawyers. And we are in our year of existence.
Fantastic.
I guess you've already answered. Who's all involved?
Well, we're actually quite a group. We've got 50 members currently, which includes four founding members, and we have an active core group of about a dozen, a little over a dozen. And our more active members have created a number of working groups. So we're really an informal organization, but we're working together very organically and very productively so far. Just in our first full year of existence, we created a Google Groups and a Facebook page, and we have one group that's working on further establishing our social media presence and getting more media exposure and hopefully in the near future creating a website for the group. Then we have another working group that a few of us formed where we collectively wrote an amicus brief to the Supreme Court in the pending marriage case, and that was co-sponsored. We don't have any formal funding for our group. Really, we're just a group of volunteers that pull together, but we did have to actually come up with a couple of $1,000 for our amicus group, for our amicus brief with the court, because it's actually quite expensive to file a brief with the Supreme Court. So what we did there is the law school that I teach at, Indiana Tech Law School, partnered with University of Denver Law School and an attorney and professor there who's very supportive of bylaw. And the two law schools both sponsored our amicus brief with the help of with Kyle, who is our lead counsel, Kyle Velt, who is a professor at University of Denver. So we also have a group that's working on, and I'm one of the people who's currently working on producing more legal scholarship on the issue of bisexual erasure. And a number of us are also planning a series of conference presentations on bisexual inclusion and bisexual jurisprudence at conferences across the country. So recently we presented at Harvard Law School just a week ago, which was wonderful.
Wow.
And yeah, it was really tremendous. And it was in Boston, you know, so we actually did have Ellen come out. I always mispronounce her name. Is it Rutstrom?
Rutstrom.
Yeah. So she came out, you know, so we had some members of the national bi community there, mixing with bylaw and the Harvard Law students. And it was just a really exciting day. It was the first ever, it was Harvard Law School's first ever bisexuality day. So we were thrilled to help put that together. And we also have presentations coming up at the Ohio Bar Association conference. We're having a special day just on LGBT issues. And so bylaw is going to be presenting there on the issue of bisexual jurisprudence and inclusion. And we're also going to have a presence at the Because conference coming up in Minneapolis. So we're working on a numerous, a vast array of projects. And we're all just doing a great job pulling together as an organic group of volunteers.
Well, we commend you. This is something we very much needed, and we're really happy you're doing it.
I was going to say, you know, like my neighbor down the street used to be president of Harvard Law School. You know, you probably heard of him. Yeah, Barack.
Oh, his last name, it starts with an O or something.
He's an Irish guy. Obama.
Right. Obama. Happy St. Patrick's Day on that note.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, how did this idea of forming this group come about?
Well, I think that a lot of people have been wanting this, but it took us all getting kind of reaching our boiling point at the same time. I was attending the Lavender Law Conference, which is the annual conference put on by the National LGBT Bar Association. And it's heavily attended by law students and also queer lawyers and a few of us professors actually go, but it's mostly lawyers and law students. And the keynote speaker 2 years ago, I guess this was 2013, was Robbie Kaplan, who's the lawyer who represented Edie Windsor in the Windsor case that we won at the Supreme Court level. And, you know, as much as Robbie Kaplan should be applauded for her great work in making history with that case, She's not really a fan of bi-inclusion. So in her keynote speech and also in her brief to the court, she's adamantly bi-exclusive. And she made a point of saying in the speech that she prefers the terminology lesbian and gays and gay marriage over same-sex marriage and over LGBT. And she said, because let's not, you know, kid ourselves. This is about gay people. That's all it's about. And I got really listening to that.
Whoa.
I was really personally offended.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was really. So, I mean, I have been working my tail off for 2 decades on equal rights for LGBT people, and I have been fighting for the cause, and I have paid my dues, and I mean, this has been an issue. I mean, LGBT rights in general has been something I have fought so hard for, and yet, once again, I'm excluded because I'm bisexual, and I'm told it's not about you at all. So, ironically, right after her keynote speech, the executive director of the National LGBT Bar Association got up and, you know, spoke to this ballroom filled with, you know, queer lawyers and law students and said, you know, we really, as an organization and a movement, want to do even better at representing diversity. How can we increase diversity in the future? Let's have a conversation about this. So So that was as open door as you could get, and I raised my hand and I said, how about more bi inclusion? And I spoke my mind and I said, you know, that I was really getting fed up with how bisexuals are time and time excluded from these dialogues, and we have so much to contribute, and we're so much a part of everything that's going on, and yet you would never know it from the face of the briefs filed in courts, from the face of the opinions, and from, I didn't say, I really didn't call out her speech. You know, I was trying to be politic about it. But I was upset, and I was very adamant about if we're going to take, you know, diversity seriously, you need to include the Bs. This is, you know, it's really about time that we be acknowledged too and be included fully. So after I said that, 3 people came up to me and said, thank you so much. That's what we've been saying for years, you know, and we just feel like we're crying out into a void, and it's about time somebody said that, and what are we going to do about this? So that's how bylaw started, is through, you know, just this group of 4 of us saying we're tired of being excluded. And so we said, we immediately on the spot decided we were going to propose a bisexual inclusion, bisexual jurisprudence panel proposal for the following year's conference. And I'm sorry to say it was immediately shot down. And again, in the most ironic kind of way, because we were asked, well, if you're going to do a panel presentation, now keep in mind, Lavender Law has a lot of different panel presentations, a lot of different topics, and some of them are really focused on queer issues, and some of them not so much. I mean, some of them are just like, you know, financial advice and banking advice and the stuff that really isn't that necessarily that pertinent to LGBT issues, but the presenters happen to be big financial sponsors, so they're kind
right.
of getting their place. So we were basically told that because there aren't enough cases out there in courts highlighting bisexuals, then we couldn't make ourselves relevant as a CLE, you know, worthy of CLE credit presentation. And we said, well, that's exactly the problem, is the fact that we're not being represented in the cases. We're not being represented in the litigation. Our very invisibility and erasure that we want to talk about in this panel. But because we couldn't point to enough cases that did highlight us, we were told that we weren't relevant enough for a panel. But we didn't take no for an answer because we were pretty fired up at that point. So we kept dialoguing with the National LGBT Bar Association. And to her credit, Darcy Chemnitz, who's the ED, really did hear us. And even though we didn't have our panel accepted, what she did give us was our first ever, she gave us space for our first ever bylaw caucus at the next year's LGBT Bar Association. So they really did come around. So a year later, we had our first ever bylaw caucus. In the meantime, you know, this core group of us grew to about a dozen, and we reached out to other friends. And so there are about a dozen of us who organized over the course of the next year and planned ahead for the following year's conference. And we had this bylaw caucus that was advertised through Lavender Law and the National LGBT Bar Association. And our turnout was tremendous. It was a full room. It was somewhere between 40 and 50 people. And we did want to keep it informal. We, you know, set the chairs in a circle and basically had people speak their minds about what they wanted to see out of this group. What did they want us to become? because this has really been very democratic and organic from the start. There's no formal officers to the group. There's no titles. There's no, ironically enough, there's no bylaws for bylaw. But we wanted the group to just kind of create itself on the spot, and it did. And so I guess I'm describing the turnout at the first ever bylaw caucus that was sponsored by the National LGBT Bar Association. And it was really tremendous, and it was actually kind of emotional because a lot of people were so grateful that we were finally doing this. For decades, bisexual lawyers and law professors and law students have been really aching for this. It's become apparent. And, you know, I had some pretty ambitious ideas of things we could do. For example, the Supreme Court amicus brief we just wrote. But a lot of people just wanted the community, just wanted to know they weren't alone. And we had people saying that that caucus was just the highlight of their experience at Lavender Law that year, just to connect with other bisexuals in the legal community. So we were all extremely gratified by just the turnout and the group of amazing people that came together that day. And so carrying forward on that momentum, we created the working groups that I described, and we've really done a lot in the past year. And we also we've got a lot of support from allies as well. Bill Singer is on the board of the National LGBT Bar Association. He's extremely supportive of us. We have some really strong support from NCLR, the National Center for Lesbian Rights. They've been tremendously supportive. This is our time, and we're really moving forward and yet trying to stay kind of informal and organic about it at the same time. So we'll see. We'll see if we can keep that kind of democratic, organic structure even as we keep growing. Since the caucus, we have been organizing through our Google groups and through our small working groups, and we have gained membership from other bisexual erasure scholars within the legal academia. So we now have a really wonderful mix of scholars, professors, practicing lawyers, lawyers who are in private practice, lawyers who are public interest lawyers or LGBT rights specific lawyers, and we would love more members. So anybody who's listening to this who, you know, is involved in the legal community or knows somebody who is and you're bisexual or bi-supportive, we would love for you to join us. And we have also, we're very diverse as far as our interests and our priorities and the things that we want to focus on. And it's really been a wonderful experience. We have a number of trans members who are really critical in helping us, you know, ourselves stay inclusive of the partnerships and the cross-sectionality that we should make sure that we're engaging in. We have a number of members who are polyamorous or, you know, very polyamory in our dialogue. And so we're very conscious.
So, yeah, it's really important. I think the one thing that everybody in bylaw agrees on, even though we're extremely diverse and we have different opinions, is we do value diversity. And we welcome into the fold people who are fighting for marriage. And, you know, like I'm one of them. I really want to fight for bisexuals to have the right to traditional marriage, to the, you know, white picket fence wedding gown. You know, there's a place for assimilationists too, and there's a place for polyamorous, you know, more alternative in your face activism. I mean, there's a place for all of us, and we're all coming to the table through bylaw, I think, and we're always striving to make sure that everybody's included in the dialogue.
I have a couple of follow-ups. First off, you know, when I think, when these lawyers come and tell you that there's no bisexual cases, I remember the softball case, and it was like Lesbian Law Center actually were the ones who fought for us in that, you know, in that softball case. So that's very specific because that was, you know, these were bisexual softball players in a gay league, and because there were four bisexuals on the championship team, they were stripped of their championship because the league considered bisexuals to be ringers, of which there could be no more than two. And there were race issues involved in that case, too, I remember.
Because all of the bisexual softball players who were excluded were African American. And that and National Center for Lesbian Rights, that's why we flagged them as being an ally right off the bat, because they fought that case. I mean, they actually sued the Gay Softball League on behalf of bisexual players. And sure enough, I mean, they've really been, I think, the most supportive
group of LGBT rights litigators out there, and they're fantastic. But that's the rarity. I mean, that's really the only case of its kind in which bisexuals, you know, have successfully sued a gay organization for excluding them. And it's not that we want to go out and sue all the bi-exclusive groups out there, but it is rare for bisexuals to get successful legal representation when they're excluded, whether from straight communities or gay communities. And that we do need to get more attorneys willing to represent us, to hear our case, to recognize that we have, you know, valid rights and complaints as well.
Hear, hear.
The other thing I was going to ask is, you know, I take it that you're mostly working with the National Bar. What about the Lawyers Guild? They tend to be a bit more radical in terms of their politics. Is there people in the guild that are part of this too?
You know what? That's a great suggestion. And we have brainstormed about different ways to outreach to allies, and that's actually not something that we have done, but we should. So, yeah, thank you for that suggestion.
Because I know some bisexual lawyers who are guild members, you know.
Yeah.
And of course they couldn't help you have come up with that $1,000 for the brief.
No, unfortunately not. But thankfully the two law schools together were able to make it happen.
Yay.
But yeah, no, I mean, really we would love to join forces with all kinds of allies out there who might be supportive. We're definitely about intersectionality and cross-sectionality. So, yeah, that's a great suggestion.
So I added a question, but I take it that you haven't actually read up on it, so I'm going to just skip it.
Well, no, I did want to – I know which question you're talking about. You're talking about the recent employment discrimination
case.
Yeah,
okay, yeah, so I'll ask it. So preparing for the interview today, I came across the Flood versus Bank of America and ABM appeal on the bylaw page. After reading the brief, I found articles with lesbian couple headlines. To me, it's biphobia and classism both wrapped up together from reading the brief. And the accusation of assault by a vacuum cord and drinking while bisexual. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Well, those particular facts I can't really speak to. But I did want to talk about the case insofar as it is the first ever employment discrimination victory by a bisexual litigant in the Federal Court of Appeals. So that's huge. And that, again, speaks to, again, how rare it is for us to actually have successes in court. So it is the first. And I also wanted to speak to the point that you raised about, you know, the news stories about this case that clearly involves us right there on the front page. You know, this is about bisexual employees who are getting discriminated against. And yet the newspaper articles describe them as lesbian. And that is exactly the problem with bi erasure that we're seeing that's epidemic. A lot of bylaws work is focusing on how that occurs in court opinions and court briefs, but it happens in the media too. And it happens in media coverage of litigation. And another example of that is Robin Oakes, who's, you know, a very prominent bisexual activist. It's her life. It's what she's about. And she and her wife got married, and their wedding was described as a wedding of two lesbians by the media.
Yeah.
And that really hurt.
We remember it when it happened. And, you know, we had different kinds of social networks in those days to fight it. But we did.
But it's still ongoing. The default is to describe people as gay and lesbian, not bisexual, even when they're very out about who they are and even when that's the subject of their case. And another, and I've written about this. I have an article that's coming out in the Michigan Journal of Gender and Law this fall about examples of bi erasure across, you know, the spectrum in both court opinions and briefs by LGBT rights lawyers and how unfortunately the courts are following the lead of the lawyers who are saying it's okay to be bi-exclusive. And so I'm really urging both LGBT rights lawyers and courts to be more conscious and more aware of the harms that are done to bisexuals when they're excluded from legal rights discourse. But another example that I highlight in my article is the example of Sandy Steyer, who was the wife of Perry, as in the Perry case that made it to the Supreme Court that was the challenge to Prop 8 in California. Sandy Steyer was being She's on the stand, and Ted Olson was her lawyer. So this is a direct examination. It's supposed to be friendly. It's supposed to be, you know, just telling the story of your client, if you're the lawyer, and helping her tell her story. So here she is being direct examined by her own attorney, Ted Olson, and he felt the need to explain away the fact that she'd previously been married to a man. So he's got her on the stand, and he says, well, how do you explain the fact that you were married to a man? I mean, first it's this, and then it's that, and then it's this, and what is it exactly? And he basically pressured her into disowning any love she ever had for her previous spouse and saying that, you know, that was completely a lie. Everything in her past was invalid. The only thing that matters is her love for the woman that she was currently married to. And so it's just heartbreaking to read that, because why is that line of inquiry necessary? Why would it matter? I mean, if she had loved her husband, she should still be entitled to equal rights to marry, just like anybody who's lesbian or anybody who's straight. So that the implication that if you've previously been married to a man, you're not entitled to an equal right to marry, what is that? And that's part of the problem of bi erasure, is it permeates even the way that our own friends and allies frame things in court. And that's what we're trying to call out and trying to change.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. I would just like really quick follow up because, sure. You know, even though I support marriage, I don't believe in it.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I've been with my partner for 28 years and we're in a domestic partnership. And because we're in Maryland, we have a lot of rights because of all the years in preparation for passing marriage in this state, we got a lot of domestic partnership rights.
Right.
So, you know, that's kind of a question to me because, you know, as we speak, the State Department is talking about removing domestic partnership from benefits, that if you're in a same-sex relationship, you're forced to get married to maintain, you know, things like health care and such. And, you know, I think it probably affects bisexual people and it affects people who are trans in relationship probably more than it affects any other parts of the community.
Yeah.
Can you talk just a bit about that?
Well, I mean, I look at marriage the way that I look at abortion. If you don't like it, don't have one, but who should make the choice, right?
So putting aside the issue of domestic partnerships, I look at marriage the way that I look at abortion. A lot of people don't necessarily like the concept of marriage, but if you don't like it, don't have one. But the issue should be who decides, who gets to make that choice.
Mm-hmm.
And the arguments that we're making in court is that it's a matter of individual autonomy, and only the individual should make this most personal, fundamental choice, and the government shouldn't be telling them they don't have a right to get married. So is marriage the most important issue? Is marriage better than domestic partnership? No, not necessarily, but it is important that bisexuals, along with lesbian gays, have that option, especially to protect their children, those people who have families. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is the system of protections that we have in place across the country. It's a system that is well established. It's ready to go. All you got to do is make sure that you can have the form that says spouse and spouse instead of husband and wife. And so marriage should be on the table, but it's not the only issue, and it's not the most important issue by far. But it is highlighted. The interesting thing about marriage and bisexuality is that marriage helps illustrate the intersectionality between sexual orientation and gender. And bisexuals can help illustrate that very clearly if only they were allowed in the dialogue. So this is an argument that we're highlighting in our amicus brief to the Supreme Court in the marriage case. Bisexuals, if we were allowed to be included in the dialogue, which we're demanding at this point, we are including ourselves in the dialogue, we help illustrate that, especially in the context of marriage, marriage really performs a beautiful platform for us to make this case. Bisexuals help illustrate that discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation is just another form of gender discrimination, and here's why. If I, as a bisexual woman, were to go to the clerk of courts in Ohio, where I used to live, and I were to say, hi, I'm bisexual, I would like to marry this man, is that okay? The clerk of courts would say, well, of course, it's okay, you're marrying a man. If I were to go to the same clerk of courts the next day and say, hi, I'm bisexual and I would like to marry this woman. Is that okay? The clerk, of course, would say, well, no, because that would be a same-sex marriage and we don't perform those in Ohio. So what's changed from one day to the next? Not my sexual orientation. My sexual orientation is exactly the same in the first scenario as the second. I've been bisexual all along. The only thing that's changed is the gender of the person I want to marry. So therefore, bisexuals help illustrate this a form of gender discrimination. And that is really significant for legal arguments because the way that equal protection law has developed, the way that constitutional law has evolved, gender discrimination gets more protection than other forms of discrimination. So once we help establish this gender discrimination, we actually make the case easier for LGBT rights lawyers to get the legal protection that they're asking for. So, you know, one of these days, hopefully the rest of the movement will wake up and see that we actually help strengthen their arguments. But currently there seems to be this trend where they're afraid of us, like we're going to muddy things up and confuse things too much. And we really don't. I think that we actually add a lot of clarity to the arguments by helping illustrate what really is going on here. And this really is a form of gender discrimination. We help illustrate that beautifully. So
I totally agree. And I think that that's why I am so jazzed about you guys, because we hear people say, well, what do you mean by erasure? What do you mean by phobia? What do you mean? Give us examples. And here you can clearly provide exactly what we're talking about.
And that's an example of how we can benefit the movement. But there's also clear examples of harms that are done by erasure. And in a legal context specifically, bisexuals face unique harms because of bi-erasure, because courts don't get who we are. They don't get that bisexuality is a valid sexual orientation and that we really exist. We are harmed in particular in the context of custody and immigration law.
Mm-hmm.
There are immigration cases where people have been denied asylum because the courts thought they were in sham marriages, because they assumed that if they were one day in a same-sex relationship, that if they were then or previously in a different sex relationship, one of those relationships couldn't possibly be valid. And so people were not trusted, were accused of being in sham relationships. In a custody context, were accused of being more unstable. They look at us going from a same-sex to a different sex relationship, and the judges typically describe that as instability and grounds for denying custody or visitation. So these are real tangible harms. We face all the same harms as lesbians and gays. When we're in a same-sex relationship, we have all the same harms done to us through queer discrimination, through sexual orientation discrimination. But we have additional harms that are compounded by bi-erasure, because the more that the LGBT movement doesn't talk about us and doesn't include us, the more judges remain honestly ignorant and harmfully so. And it's not that it's ill-intentioned. They're just not being given the information about who we are and that we're existent, that our sexual orientation is valid too. And everybody has a responsibility to reverse the damage of bisexual erasure, but especially the LGBT rights movement. And I'd like to think that there's progress being made. I'd like to think that organizations like the National Center for Lesbian Rights and the National LGBT Bar Association and even all those organizations that are just changing their names and making, you know, changes in small ways by being more inclusive in their terminology, I'd like to think we're moving in the right direction, but people need to be very conscious and aware that bisexual exclusion and erasure is a real problem and that including us benefits everybody.
Okay, thank you.
I would say, really, like, we have a case in Chicago which clearly illustrates how bisexuals are discriminated against, because it's a Polish immigrant.
Eva Whitlatt, yes.
Yeah. And that's the question, right? It's a sham marriage because he's really gay, and like that's not the facts. And you know, in England there was the Jamaican man who I think he's still in England, but they were trying to send him back because he's bisexual. And like you go to Jamaica, they're not going to make a distinction.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and there are other cases too. The courts tend, if you do a term search for cases where bisexuals are mentioned, we're not even called bisexual by the courts because they don't have the vocabulary. But what they tend to say is, there are, you know, I did
some research and found a couple of other cases where the immigration board basically said, wait, this person was with a man, and now this person is with a woman. Therefore, we can't trust that the relationship is valid. So they're not even, they don't even have the word bisexual to describe what's going on. It's just out of their realm of comprehension. And that's a problem. Yeah, that's a real problem. They just don't even understand that it exists.
Shall we wrap this up, John, or?
Yeah. I figure you do the, all links will be provided on the website.
I will do that. I just wanted to ask, because this is your question, but I guess it's mine now. What are your plans for the future?
Well, we'd love to continue the work that we've done in the past year. We've got the amicus brief that's just been filed with the Supreme Court. We actually got coverage of our amicus brief through Advocate Magazine, which was great. So we do want to get – we need to get the word out that we exist and increase our membership and just increase awareness. And like you said, building bridges with other ally groups. We would love to hear from anybody who would be supportive of us in the legal community and have something to contribute. We do want to put resources together. We would like to get some – not. I mean, we're – I and another person are have pending publications through Law Review, but do people really read Law Review articles? Not really, unless you're in the academia. We'd like to get more accessible resources out there to people in the form of brochures and, you know, maybe issue statements, talking points, just helping people, like I said, helping the court become more aware of bisexuality and how we should be included in LGBT rights discourse and how we face unique hurdles, for example, in immigration and custody. So we'd like to get more publications out there. We're working on creating a website. We would love to hear from more potential members, but we are purely a volunteer group so far. So currently our plan is to stay organic, democratic, volunteer, not yet formalized through 501c3 or 501c6 structure. And so far, it's working great. We're just it's a great group of people, and we're working together really well. So,
I guess the first nonprofit lawyer that shows up is going to file those.
No, I mean, some people are kind of thinking, you know, we could raise money if we did this, we did that. But we don't have a hierarchy. We don't have formal officers. I mean, I am not the face of bylaw. I'm one of many faces of bylaw. And so it's kind of nice that we're starting off as a collective. It's
you could have,
it's kind of what we did. We kind of started off as a collective, and it kind of just migrated to where, you know, each of us had a responsibility. And but yeah, it was pretty cool.
I was going to say that I actually worked for a 501c3 organization that was a collective, and. We had a formal board president, right? We created a formal board and had a formal board president, but, you know, it operated in a consensus, even in board meetings. The entire staff came to the board meeting and operated on a consensus basis. So it's possible to do that and legally.
Yeah. And we'll keep reexamining that as we grow for sure. And we all have different things we want to see out of the group. And so far the group can provide different, it can fulfill different needs and desires. And mine is to really change the terminology of lawyers and judges and to have opinions become more bi-inclusive. That's my big issue. But other people want bylaw, you know, as a social group, just a way to network and to find other fellow travelers. And that's great.
I'll tell you, my buddy is a public defender in Montgomery County next door, and I'm going to, like, put it out to him to see if he knows people that would be interested in joining.
Please do. That would be great. Thank you.
All links will be provided on the website. And is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I just really thank you for the opportunity to spread the word about bylaw, and thank you for all the work you guys are doing. It's fabulous, and it's great to be a part of the bigger movement.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I'll just say that, like, you know, I wish you were around, like, 20 years ago when I had when I had discrimination at work. And
yeah.
My own, like, you know, my own company's, you know, LGBT group wouldn't take it on because I was bisexual.
And you know what? That's an important point, too, is one thing bylaw can provide is we, you know, a lot of people in bylaw are practicing lawyers. So we can, you know, if somebody is discriminated against on the basis of being bisexual, if somebody is facing a custody issue where their bisexuality is being abused in the legal arguments to the judge, we have lawyers. So, you know, even if you don't want to be active in our group as a volunteer, if you're looking, if you know somebody who's looking for a lawyer because they're being discriminated against for their bisexuality, please come to us. We do have practicing lawyers in states across the country.
Great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Great. I just want to remind everybody, thank you so much, Nancy, for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was really great. Thanks.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Remember, you are not wrong, you are not broken, and you are not alone. You are a human being, and you are bisexual. Goodbye.
Thank you so much.
Bye. The views expressed on the Bicast do not necessarily represent those of Binet USA or the Bicast crew.